So Mark 11, and we're going to go ahead and start reading, starting at the fig tree again, before the incident in the temple. But we need to push past this, obviously, because we need to make progress. And the next story after this, because it ties so closely to the parable of the tenants, we're actually going to try to get into chapter 12. Parable of the tenants, of course, Hal mentioned last time during our discussion. It really fits in with the themes that we're seeing here, as he said. And so really, in this whole section of the gospel, we're going to be focusing on one of two things, and often these things together. One, we need to get Jesus to the cross. There's a focus on that. Either he's going to be talking about it, or he's going to be doing things that will be provoking the leadership to take him there. And obviously the temple incident would have been one of those big things that would have provoked the authorities to do something about Jesus, as the text says. But the other theme, and really pretty much everything revolves around one of these two, is the spiritual rejection of Israel. And that is obviously related to the death of Jesus. That's the capstone. That's the grand summary, the grand offense that ultimately causes the rejection of God upon Israel as it was then understood. So really, everything we see is going to be revolving around these two things. And even some, like the discussion of prayer in the fig tree, we're going to see is actually not just a random discussion of prayer. It actually even fits into these themes to a certain degree. So let's read, starting with Mark 11, 12. Actually, let's start with 11. And he went into Jerusalem, into the temple, and looking around at everything, since it was already evening, he went unto Bethany with the 12. Seemingly throwaway statement, what's the point of this? If you think about the beginning of the chapter, what's the first thing that happens? It's the triumphal entry, right? Jesus is coming in, there's big fanfare, everybody's glad he's here. What does he do when he gets into the city? He looks around the temple and goes home. Okay? If you think about this paragraph, this sentence, in connection with the triumphal entry, you, I think, miss what Mark is trying to do here. They're not actually connected. And, for example, the NET Bible has the next subheading after verse 11, connecting 11 to what comes before. I actually think that might be a mistake. Now, last time, we talked about the sandwiching of the temple incident with the fig tree. There's actually another way you could look at this. And it comes by including verse 11 with what comes after. Okay? You think about this. Verse 11, what is Jesus doing? He's in the temple. Right? What's the very next thing that happens? He curses the fig tree. What's the next thing that happens? Jesus goes back to the temple. And this time there's the action of cleansing or parabolic destruction, however you want to call it. Then what do we have? We have the fig tree again, right? Then what do we have? Well, next we have a discussion within the temple again, a confrontation between Jesus and its leadership, because they come to ask him, what kind of authority do you have to do this kind of stuff? And so what you have is a structure, potentially, even other than the sandwich structure, that once again ties these things together. The fig tree is meant to be read as exemplifying what's going on here and here and here. This is all intertwined, whether you just look at it as the sandwich, as this is the main piece. As I view this really as the height of all of this right here. Or if you view it as just being intertwined to understand all of this. Regardless, you have to understand both of these as a unit. He knows they're not going to be there, doesn't he?
That's right.
And I think that is a point that needs to be made. There's that one, and there's one more that I really think that Mark is putting here to make everybody see this is more than just an incident with a fig tree, right? Not only that, but at the very last statement of the next paragraph is what? And his disciples heard it. Of course his disciples heard it. They were standing right there. That's a part of the story. And his disciples heard it. That's actually put there as a foreshadowing, as a little trigger by the author of this to say, and the disciples heard it, hint, hint, think about this, something else is going to happen later. We've seen this before with what Mark has done. Mark is doing it again here. And I think this emphasis on it's very green and it's not even the time for figs. All of this is meant as a symbol. This is meant as something larger than just the incident itself. And so I think you're right. I think that is an important thing. And also, what is it about the tree? What does the tree look fruitful from afar off? Sure, it's fully leaved. You're like, hey, that's very healthy. But was it really fruitful? Well, no. And that, of course, has implications for who this is supposed to be symbolizing as well. The fig tree being, of course, Israel, right? So then there's, you know, the cursing of the fig tree. Next, there is the incident in the temple. And I would argue very strongly this is not a cleansing at all. This is a, I'm pouring judgment upon you and your leadership. So here's the question. What does the temple mean to the Jews? Does the temple mean to the Jews what our church building means to us? It's a lot more, right? What does it mean? It's going to be the center of their religion. It's the sign that the God of the earth dwells among them, right? It's also probably going to function as some sort of national symbol, just like for us, well, the White House. You see the White House, you think United States of America. It's also going to have that. Now, what happened in this temple that was actually significant for the people? Nothing. It was just, hey, that's our spiritual centerpiece. There was the sacrifices, right? And so this was not only the spiritual, this is where we, you know, might come to commune. This is where the chief sacrifices happen, right? And so that's pretty big. Now let's think about what Jesus actually said in here. Did anybody look up the passages in Isaiah and Jeremiah that Jesus quoted? Anybody look them up? Everybody did? Good. Okay. What's the general tenor of the passage in Isaiah? You can even get the idea of it just by looking at the quote. My house will be called a house of prayer for all the nations. It's happy, right? It's good. And it really is. If you look in the context of the passage, it's happy. Everything is going well. But look at Jeremiah, the statement, the den of robbers. Go to Jeremiah 7:11. If you start in verse 8, you get, but if you trust in deceptive words, whereby you will not benefit, and murder, and commit adultery, and steal, and swear wrongly, and offer incense to the goddess Baal, and go after foreign gods that you do not know, so that it will be ill for you, and if you came and stood before me in the house where my name has been called on it, and you said, we have kept away from doing all these abominations, surely my house, there where my name has been called on it, has not become a den of robbers before you? There it is. This is exactly what he's referring to. And I, behold, I have seen it, says the Lord, because go to my place, which was in Shiloh, there where I made my name and camp formerly, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. And now because you have done all these deeds, and I spoke to you, and you did not hear me, and I called you, and you did not answer, I will also do to the house. What's the house? Temple. I will do that to the house where my name is called on it, and which you trust in it, and to the place that I gave to you and to your fathers, just what I did to Shiloh. And I will cast out you from before me, just as I cast out your kinsfolk, all the offspring of Ephraim. What's he referring to? What's that? He's referring to the temple. What's he referring to in the past in terms of Shiloh and Ephraim? He's referring to how the Assyrians, God used the Assyrians to come in and wipe them out because of their sinfulness, right? They scattered Ephraim. They took them over. They were, you know, brutally messed with them. And so that's what Jeremiah's referring to here when he's talking about this judgment that's going to come upon the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah. Because you've turned my house into a den of robbers, God's going to come and wipe you out just like he did them. And so when Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament, when he goes from Isaiah, which is happy, saying this is what the house should have been. It should have been a house of prayer. What you've made it is a den of robbers. If they would have recognized that statement. They would have recognized the context, and they would have recognized what Jesus was going for. And what Jesus was saying is, you're going to be under a curse, just like your forefathers were under a curse, because they rejected God as well. There's also a quote in Zechariah that some people point to that this would be very much on their minds, and wasn't quoted here, but very much on their minds, where it talks about how God would cast out all of those who are selling things out of the temple, right? And so why did he not pick that one? Why did he pick this one? I don't know. I think it's really because of the overtones of what he wanted to bring out. It's not necessarily that they were robbing, though in reality they probably were, right? I've heard that they used to take advantage of people, especially Gentiles, coming in through the exchange rate. And you can't use dirty money in the temple. You have to exchange it for clean money, and so that they'll trade that out and actually rob you. But I think it's not so much that exact connotation. I think it's the larger picture that Jesus is going for here, to say, it should have been this, happy Isaiah. It's actually this, you're going to be judged, Jeremiah. So this is another case where he brings in the Old Testament that really brings out a theme here that says, well, what is God going to do? God isn't going to cleanse this thing. God is going to come do what he did with what the Babylonians did when they came in, and they're going to wipe you out. So once again, I don't think cleansing is a very good image here. But let's keep in mind this one thing, because we're going to get a lot of this temple going to be destroyed, Jerusalem going to be sacked whenever we get to the Olivet Discourse in a few chapters. We're going to be getting to this focus on the physical destruction of what was going on. But we need to keep that in the background of what's actually going on here. The point is not the city's going to be destroyed. The point is not the temple's going to be destroyed. The point is Israel is being rejected, right? The physical rejection, destruction by Titus in AD 70, is not the big deal. I mean, it's a big deal, but it's not the big deal. The big deal is God saying, you who are supposedly my people have rejected me, so I'm going to call another people, which is not my people, to be mine. And so the disciples at this point are going to see this. Now, does this say anything about Gentiles? Well, no, it doesn't say anything about Gentiles yet. That's going to come in later. But definitely, Israel, as currently understood, was very clearly being rejected by these actions. And so let's say you were the leadership of this church, Edward. Let's say you're a deacon, or perhaps Hal. You're up here preaching. Jesus walks in while you're preaching. He pushes over your pulpit and pushes you out of the way. Not in a nice way, but just in a get off that. What does that tell you about what Jesus thinks about this church and its leadership? He disapproves, right? When Jesus comes in here, the implication of this is not just going to be, I don't like these money changers. And the leadership is going to see this, as you see in the text. The implication is not, I just don't like what these guys are doing. The implication is, I don't like this whole mess at all. I think your leadership is really not taking care of this place. This is a condemnation of how they are doing worship at the time, how they are doing their spiritual acts. So let's keep that in mind as we get to our main discussions for today. Now, you get into the second fig tree incident. And so they leave the temple, they come back. So let's read that, because I don't think we've really read that in here yet. Verse 20. And going early, so this would be the next morning, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. Same fig tree. It was really green, very bushy, lots of leaves. Now it's withered from the roots. And Peter, remembering, said to him, Rabbi, behold, fig tree which you cursed, it's withered. And answering, Jesus said to them, have faith in God. Truly I say to you that whoever says to this mountain, be lifted up and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes what he is saying will be, it will be for him. For this reason I say to you, whatever you pray for and you ask, believe that you will receive, and it will be for you. And while standing praying, forgive if you have something against someone, in order that your Father, which is in heaven, will forgive you of your trespasses. And so, you might think this is kind of out of left field. We've suddenly switched topics. We come back to the fig tree. The fig tree just sort of now launches into a discussion on prayer. It's not a discussion of the temple. It's not a discussion of the Jewish leadership, nor is it a discussion of Jesus' death. But actually, even some of those elements are there, if you think about it. First of all, what was the temple standing on? What is Jerusalem standing on? The Temple Mount, right? In terms of where he actually is, he's probably standing on the Mount of Olives. But where was he just at? Well, he was just at the Temple Mount the previous morning. So what is the idea of this statement? This isn't just random, any mountain. This is not talking about mountains in Colorado, right? This is a little bit too much of a coincidence in this context to say this is just any mountain, something generic. Jesus is actually talking about what he's been doing, right? And also, the subject itself is actually very relevant at this point. What was the temple supposed to be, according to Jesus' quote from Isaiah? It's supposed to be a house of prayer. Well, he just said it was going to be destroyed. So what do you need to discuss after this? Well, you need to discuss prayer, right? Other relevant subjects would be worship. What do you do when you're about to lose the central place of prayer of your nation? Well, let's talk about what happens. And so Jesus launches into a discussion on prayer. So it's not actually random. It's not just the fig tree as a foil for, hey, let's have an excuse to talk about prayer. Even in this context, even the discussion itself is tempered around the idea of the prayer for really the destruction, the overthrow of the leadership of Israel. But now let's talk about the principles of this at least a little bit. So does this mean that if you really believed it, right, you could walk outside and say, I want this building to be thrown into that field over there, right? And you really believed it, that would happen. Is that the point of this? Statements like this have to be tempered by some understanding of, one, someone who has true faith in God is going to have a mind tempered by the mind of God as well. There's also this, you have to bring in the idea of the will of God. You're not going to be able to pray against the will of God. And, you know, God's not going to be forced to do what you said. Like, you pray and God's like, my hand's caught behind my back, right? In college, there were some people that actually believed, first of all, just talk about the idea of, like, David would have the imprecatory prayer of praying destruction down on someone, praying some sort of damnation on someone or some sort of punishment for something they did. They very much wouldn't do that, not just because perhaps things have changed, but because they believed that you could actually pray and pray condemnation down on someone, even if it was someone that God intended to bless. That if you do that and you had enough faith, you could actually bring that about. I think that's a very big misunderstanding of the nature of prayer and the nature of the will of God. But the positive point of this is very simple. What does Jesus say? He says in verse 22, have faith in God. Where is the power of prayer? The power of prayer is in God. The power of prayer is not in you. The strength of prayer is not in you. Your personal faith when you pray is very relevant for this. But don't confuse that with you actually performing something, right? If you pray for something and something happens as you prayed for, don't confuse this with your awesomeness, okay? It's not. It actually has very little to do with you. A lot more to do with God if you actually were to put it in the scales. Your faith is important. But God was actually the one who brought it about. But the major point of this really is it's not just a discussion on prayer. It's a discussion of the temple. It's a discussion of the people. It's a discussion of disciples in light of the fact that what's about to happen, you need to have faith in God and you need to pray. And another important principle here is the idea that if you do have something against someone, then you need to confess that. You need to deal with that. You need to forgive them, right? Or what? Or God will not hear. Now, some of you might have a verse 26. Mine jumps from 25 to 27. I'm guessing King James has 26, but most of the modern translations do not. It's really, I mean, there's lessons to be learned about prayer from this, but the main point really is tying this whole thing together. It's still within the same theme of prayer after the central place of prayer for the nation has been demolished, both spiritually because God has rejected them, and physically eventually whenever it actually gets destroyed. I think the problem is not that they're doing that. I think the problem is they're doing it within the Temple Mount itself and not doing it honestly. I mean, especially today, but even then, there would have been a number of people that actually would not have animals at all. And you wouldn't want to, as a matter of your, you know, public worship, keep them from actually participating, right, by not having an animal. You're still sacrificing if you go and you pay for an animal to give, just as if you were had animals and you choose one out of your flock. So I don't think that's actually the issue. But you did remind me of something, though. The Jews had a central physical place for worship. Christianity, through this, very much learned early on, that's no longer the case, right? We're no longer situated around a central city. We're no longer situated around a physical building. We're all temples of the Holy Spirit, right? And this is how we do all of our worship. With Islam, you have a reversal of that once again. You're back to people focusing on a physical place, as if this is the special place whenever you have Mecca. You also had a reversion in Christianity to this same idea when at least the Western church really started focusing on Rome. Where when people say the city of Rome, well, that's the center of the church. Oh, no, it just got sacked by Gauls. What does this do to the church? And Augustine has to write and say nothing. It does nothing to the church because the church is not a physical place. But Christianity did sort of start getting into that, because they started confusing Rome with the center of Christianity, when the center of Christianity is actually its people, bishops on down. Once again, it's in the land. It has to come back to there again. I agree. I think that's what this is pointing against, to say this landlocking, this focus here is going to be wrong. So let's go ahead and move on. I hate to hurry through this, but if you get to the next one, this discussion of the authority of Jesus, you have to get to the tenets. And chapter 12 is a very unfortunate chapter, right, for this reason. Because, you know, when you get into the story of the questioning of the authority of Jesus, in a sense, he doesn't respond. He just says, by what authority did John do? But the reality is he did respond, and he responded in the parable of the tenets. So let's read the end of chapter 11. Verse 27, they came again to Jerusalem while Jesus was walking in the temple. So this is this incident right here. Was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests, the experts in the law, and the elders came up to him and said, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do these things? Jesus said to them, I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I do these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from people? Answer me. They discussed with one another, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say from people, well, they feared the crowd, for they considered John to be truly a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we don't know. And then Jesus said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things. So Jesus brings in John again. We've seen John a number of times within this, but Jesus brings it back. And so this is going to be, I think, in the disciples' minds. When we talk about the spiritual rejection of Israel, are we talking about the spiritual rejection of all Jews? Answer, no, right? Was John rejected? Well, no, he was the Elijah to come before. Would the people that repented at John's message, would they be rejected? Well, no, that was the message of God that they were supposed to get. What about all the people that repented at Jesus' message? Mostly Jews, right? Are are they going to be rejected? Well, no, right? The disciples themselves, all Jewish. So it wasn't a complete disintegration, a complete rejection of all of Israel. It was a rejection of how they understood Israel. It was a rejection of who was the top dog, who was the leadership, what was the nature of this whole relationship between God and Israel. And so were there lots of Jews here that were true believers in God? Absolutely. And they would not be rejected by God, including John. So the chief priest, right, the story of the chief priest asking Jesus this question, obviously they're using the instance of what he did to say, hey, by what authority do you do this, right? They recognized that what he did, and that's why they're asking the question, they recognized that what he did is a critique of them. They see that, and they're like, by what authority do you do this? This is our job to run this place. It's our job to regulate it, to legalize it, whatever. By what authority do you do this thing? Jesus, because he's very wise, comes at them with the John question, and they can't answer because they're afraid, right? They can't say, well, from God, because, well, they would have proven to be wrong because they didn't ever listen to John. But they also can't say, oh, well, it's from just people or just from himself or something like that, because the people would likely lynch them at the time, which doesn't really work with their whole plan, right? Because John was very popular, which is, of course, good news, at least from our perspective, not from theirs. And so they have to say, we don't know, which is just giving up. And so Jesus says, well, that's why I'm not going to tell you. And then he actually, I think, gives his answer to them, all right, in the parable of the tenants, what he feels about this whole situation, all right? So let's read that. Then he began to speak to them in parables. This is not a long period of time. It's, well, I'm not going to tell you. Then he started speaking to everyone in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a fence around it, dug a pit for its wine press, and built a watchtower. Then he leased it to the tenant farmers and went on a journey. At harvest time, he sent a slave to the tenants to collect from them his portion of the crop. But those tenants seized his slave, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. So he sent another slave to them again. This one they struck on the head and treated outrageously. He sent another, and that one they killed. They happened to many others, some of whom were beaten, others killed. He had one left, his dear son. Finally, he sent him to them, saying, they will respect my son. But those tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they seized him and killed him, and threw his body out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Have you not read this scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This is from the Lord and is marvelous in our eyes. Now they wanted to arrest him. Who's they? Right, the people he had just fought with, right? They wanted to arrest him, but they feared the crowd because they realized that he told this parable against them. So they left him and went away. Now, one of the purposes of parables is actually to hide. We often think of parables as, well, they're just nice stories to actually be able to bring out the truth. In actuality, some of these parables would have been very confusing to people. And so in some cases, they were to be a little bit covert. In this case, I bet you a lot of the people listening didn't get it, right? But you know who got it? The people it was intended for, right? So let's think about it. Who's the vineyard in this case? Israel. Israel's the vineyard, all right? Who are the tenants that the owner gave the vineyard to? Pharisees, Sadducees, the leadership, right? And so who are the servants that he keeps sending? The prophets, right? Okay, and John the Baptist, he would have certainly been one as well. And so what do they keep doing to these guys? What they did in the Old Testament to many of the prophets, they beat them or put them in prison or killed them, right? Jeremiah had to flee the country. Actually, he was taken out of the country by, I believe, some of his sympathizers. Wicked kings especially did not like prophets, right? Because when prophets stood up against the kings and said, here's what you're doing wrong, Of course, John the Baptist is an example. He stood up against Herod and said, that whole marriage thing, no, that doesn't fly, right? That's a good question, though. It'd be interesting to see which ones exactly were killed. I know a number were killed and a number were imprisoned. I think some actually made it out alive. Now, occasionally you did have prophets that would preach something and then the people would listen, right? But you're right, most of them, especially the ones not only for the destruction of Jerusalem, but also the destruction of the northern kingdom. They preached to say, hey, repent. And they didn't listen, so foreign nations came in and wiped them out. Edwin? So the servants here, who are supposed to go to the vineyard owners and say, you know, of course the parable is, bring the fruits. Of course, the spiritual application is, you know, bring the sacrifices, bring the worship, whatever it happens to be. Of course, in actuality, you know, repent and don't be sinful. But one after one, even though the vineyard owner kept sinning, he just didn't just sin one, he just sinned over and over and over again. They kept getting beaten. And so at the end he says, well, I'll send my son. Of course, who is that? Jesus, right? And so that they say, and this is once again Jesus, because this is before his death, right? And so this is proleptic. This is talking about what's happening in the future. And so what are they going to do? Well, they're going to say, hey, he's the heir. Let's kill him. And so that's ultimately the story. Now, the story also shows up in Acts as well, except people are named. Remember the stoning of Stephen, right? Stephen did the same exact story, except he didn't tell a parable. He actually told it as a story. And at the end, he said, you're just like your forefathers who killed the prophets. You killed Jesus. And, of course, condemned them for it. And then they killed him just like they'd killed all the prophets before and killed Jesus himself. So once again, just right in line with their normal behavior. So that's why you have to read 12, the first part of 12, the parables, the tenets, with what just happened. Because Jesus is responding to the question that they just asked him. Right? Jesus is not happy with them. Jesus is not pleased. Jesus is confronting them, confounding them both with his wisdom, as he'll continue to do with the next few stories, but also using a parable to say, you're just like your fathers. You're hurting, you're killing the prophets, and you're going to kill me, and I know it. So the parable of the tenants is also a good story for us to realize that in some cases, these parables aren't meant for you. Okay? Now, granted, you could fit yourself within the parable of the tenants, but we need to realize whenever we're interpreting Scripture that sometimes these things actually don't immediately apply to you. Does this one immediately apply to you? Or any of you happen to be Jewish leadership who's going to kill Jesus in the future, and he's mad at you because you just questioned his authority because he just questioned yours? Well, no. Are there spiritual lessons we can garner from this? Well, obviously, yes. But this is one of the things that we have to keep in mind whenever we're trying to read the Gospels. Some of this stuff is actually very poignant. It's very pointed for a particular purpose, all right? And it's to convey a message, to understand something. And this understanding, in this particular case, is Mark's big theme. Jesus' death is coming, and the spiritual rejection of Israel is imminent because of it and all the other prophets that they had killed. So since we actually do have about 3 or 4 minutes, I wanted to point out something else. Did anybody look at the fig tree incident in Matthew? Anybody? We should totally do that. Because I think this is actually a really good case for something that happens very often in the Gospels. It will help us keep in mind a few things. I think we want to go to Matthew 21. And this is more general about just some of the issues that you have to keep in mind whenever you're understanding the gospel or understanding the gospels and how to interpret them. Matthew 21. At the beginning, there's the triumphal entry. Next thing is the whatever in the temple. My subheadings for the Net Bible say cleansing. The very next thing is, now early in the morning, this is verse 18 in Matthew 21. Now, early in the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry. After noticing a fig tree by the road, he went to it, but found nothing on it except leaves. He said to it, "Never again will there be fruit from you." And the fig tree withered at once. When the disciples saw it, they were amazed, saying, "How did the fig tree wither so quickly?" Jesus answered them, "I tell you the truth. If you have faith and do not doubt, not only will you do what is done to this fig tree, but you will say to this mountain, 'Be lifted up and thrown into the sea.' It will happen. And whatever you ask in prayer, if you believe, you will receive." So it's clearly the same incident, right? It's fig tree, it's the withering, it's the leaves, it's even the exhortation to prayer and some of the instruction on it. And it also happens right after the same incident in the temple. Yet what's the major difference between this and Mark? It's chronologically different, where Mark has them split, right, into this structure. But Matthew has the whole event after the incident in the temple. Question number two, Gospel of John. Where is the incident in the temple? What's that? Right, it's at the very beginning of the Gospel of John, right? This is not towards the beginning of Jesus' ministry, is it? Right? This is shortly before he actually dies. This has led a number of people, sometimes this leads people to say, okay, well, this was actually, there was two cleansings, right? There was one at the beginning of his life, or even this story, they might say, maybe this happened twice. But this has led a number of people to look at the Gospels and say, okay, what's up with this? Because clearly, Matthew is different than Mark here. It's actually different in a number of places in similar ways, where they move little incidents around, change where they are and whatnot. What this has led a lot of people to do is to say, when we think of history, that's not exactly what they're trying to write. Now, are they concerned with history? The answer is, of course, yes. Jesus came in history, and all of these Gospels are couched within the narratives of history, which are obviously historical bound to a certain sense. But the point of these Gospels is not to actually write a historical biographical account. Right? They're not actually here to do that. The point of these Gospels is not physical so much as it's more spiritual. Which, of course, leads to interesting situations like this. How do you reconcile? Well, did it happen before, or did it happen to both before and after? You could get worked up about it, or you could be like me and go, it doesn't really matter. The point's still the same. And whenever you're looking at each individual gospel, you look at it and see, okay, what was the gospel writer doing here? What is he actually trying to communicate? Now, the question is also comes up, which was written first, Mark or Matthew? Let's say they are dependent. Did Matthew shrink the story into one, or did Mark break it up to purposely do that? Good question. I don't know. Or even the timing of the cleansing of the temple. The destruction of the temple, is that the best way? The cleansing of the temple is so much easier to say than the parabolic destruction of the temple. But one thing you need to keep in mind in gospel studies is you need to keep this dynamic in your head, right? As we've seen, you sometimes see the pen of Mark slip in and put in notes to tell the reader, this is what's going on. Or this is what you need to pay attention to, right? We saw it with the feeding of the multitude, followed by the incident of Jesus walking on water, right? And there was that little note about the disciples not really getting things. That was Mark. We also saw it with those things that you brought up, Chip, in the first fig tree incident. We're going to see it in the Olivet Discourse, where this little parenthetical note, at least some translations will put it parenthetically, that says, "Let the reader understand." That's Mark saying, let the reader understand what is being spoken here in secrecy, in a sense. You'll see that. But you also have to, and if you don't recognize this, I really don't think you can get Mark. I don't think you can get any of the Gospels, because they all do this. You need to look at how the stories are arranged. You need to see what they're trying to do within the larger literary scope of the work, or you won't get it. If you ignore Mark's literary features, Mark is a rather boring gospel. I really think so. I used to think so, because I didn't really see his literary features. But if you see what he's doing and how he groups his stories, how he does his themes. He's just as complicated and just as interesting as any of the other Gospels, because he comes off as so simple, but in reality, he's actually very complex and very, very deep. So that's just a, keep this in mind when you're studying the Gospels. You'll notice it if you ever start comparing the two or three, especially the Synoptic Gospels. You'll notice these, okay, there's slight differences. The question you need to ask yourself is, why? And in this particular case, this totally makes sense, because Mark is trying to link these things. Matthew, maybe he was not as concerned, but even the context links them as well anyway. So, any questions about that?